I'm very interested in this, the psychology behind it. With leftists, I would term it, under the Diagnostic Statistical Manual of Mental Disorders, I would include socialist delusional disorder. I would put it in the Diagnostic Manual of Mental Disorders.
David.
Because the hypocrisy is unbelievable from a lot of people.
Can I respond on that?
From the left side.
All right, socialist disillusionment.
Socialist delusional disorder.
Go on.
With respect, it does rather sound like a caricature of the Stalinist Soviet Union where people with the wrong political beliefs have been carted away and you've diagnosed as being politically or medically suspect. So I do take objection to that.
Yeah, well, you will, because you're Labour, aren't you?
OK, Stephen.
Are you doing that coffee pouring thing in the background? Or are you taking...
By that coffee pouring thing, do you mean, am I pouring coffee? To which the answer is yes.
Well, you know the point when we recorded the first episode of this podcast in its current format, I think you insisted on pouring coffee obnoxiously in front of the microphone.
Oh, no, I think I've done that twice because I am obnoxious, but it's never meant to be a thing. It's just to kind of try and get the listeners to need to go to the toilet.
Right, okay. That's good. Shall we, in some roundabout way, introduce this and then, talk about stuff to do with politics?
Sure. Yeah. Hi. When do we begin? Now?
Now's fine.
Okay. hello, everybody. Welcome to the Right Dishonourable Podcast. My name is Jazza, and I am joined, as ever, by the gorgeous, the wonderful, the creative, the intelligent Jimmy Nichols.
Thank you very much.
That's quite an introduction.
They can't verify the gorgeous bit because they are only listening, but I'm sure they can use their imaginations.
Yeah, I mean, only a person so attractive can come up with beautiful tones of their voice such as yours.
I believe the term is mellifluous.
Oh, God. Well, that's a big word for a dyslexic to hear, isn't it? We are... this is the Right Dishonourable Contest. And
have you said that already?
Yes, but I'm covering my back because I wasn't sure if I had.
You're emphasising it.
And we talk about politics, social issues and current events every week, hopefully. Apart from last week.
I'm
surprised you haven't brought up yet, Jimmy.
I'd sort of forgotten about
really
it.
Let you speak.
Until you said every week, and then I immediately realised. But I did pull some similar shit, probably nine months ago.
Yeah, every time I've been abroad and Jimmy's like, oh yeah, I'll take over the podcast, I'll get like John on or something. And it does not always work, does it, Jimmy?
I have no friends other than you, it's tough. I just rub it in, but
I don't know whether that makes me feel really loved or sad for you. You poor thing. If I'm the best you can get, then Christ. You really need to aim higher, babe.
Thanks, I appreciate that.
Welcome. So this week, what are we going to be talking about, Jimmy?
So I thought we'd start with a meandering discussion now of the Clinton-Trump debate, which
Crump. Hashtag Crump.
Crump. The crumpet debate, which presumably everyone's kind of
digested. How has that not been used?
They just don't have my vision. These people at the newspapers. So we're going to be
these people in the newspapers, in the press,
awful journalists who tell lies, as Trump always points out. And then we're going to talk a little bit about the Labour Party conference, which happened. It was sometime this week, wasn't it?
It happened in a parallel universe,
right?
But also around Liverpool. And there's been a load of quite awkward stuff about anti-Semitism. Again, Ken Livingstone is still allowed to say things. It's all very awkward.
That's a shocking oversight from Labour's point of view that Ken Livingstone hasn't been permanently gagged.
or sent somewhere abroad. It's all incredibly awkward. And then finally, we're just getting breaking news that our Theresa May, she is going to Currently, it's Tory Party conference this week, isn't it?
It is indeed.
And she is going to be planning on triggering Article 50, which initiates the whole process of the United Kingdom leaving the European Union. She's going to be triggering that by the end of March 2017.
That's exciting.
So I have now have a timetable on my identity being ripped to shreds. fun.
I think you're still like relatively unique in considering yourself a European.
I am a special snowflake.
I mean, you are a special snowflake in many ways, but just the
I'm
not sure the European thing is much of a thing as it goes, but I'm sure we'll get onto that later. Did you watch all of the Trump-Clinton debate or the Crumpet debate?
I watched all of the Crumpet debate live and live tweeted it.
Oh, was that exciting? Was that fun had by all?
I was incredibly tired because it happened between the hours of 2 a.m. and 4 a.m. in the UK, and I was like, oh, why couldn't they have done it like the Olympics so that everything happened a little bit earlier, so that everybody in other time zones other than the ridiculous US time zone, the end of the world, is able to watch it. I thought it was really inconsiderate of them to not think of all of their international viewers, but it was long.
It was an hour and a half, wasn't it?
It was over an hour and a half, ran by about 10 minutes.
Yeah.
Which I was surprised that like network TV allowed that kind of thing to happen, but it was enlightening. Well, people have been thinking about and have been talking about Clunt.
Yeah, very nearly there, mate. Very nearly.
Yeah, thanks. Clinton versus Trump. Oh, they've been pontificating about it for months and months and months, and been incredibly excited about the whole thing.
So apparently, according to the polls, more people thought Clinton won it, quote unquote, than thought Trump won it. Like, I think it's like more, it was more than 50% anyway.
Oh, yeah, it was something like 69.
Is it that
70,
high?
It was, yeah, it was really like Clinton. I think there was a CNN poll directly after, and I'll check 538 right now, but I think that was the closest. They had a load of undecided voters, and like Hillary trounced them. Did you watch it at all?
Yeah, I was actually in Chicago when the debates were going on, so I went down to a this pub which was full of Democrats, as could evidently be told by whose jokes they were laughing at. And
did you ever obnoxiously laugh at anything Trump based, just for a little bit of fun?
The thing is, people were kind of laughing at Trump's jokes, but they were laughing at Trump rather than at the jokes, if you see what I mean. So I don't know if anyone would have noticed.
That's really interesting. You've got quite a good perspective there in terms of having being able to see how the people who are actually going to decide this election, seeing how they reacted. And obviously you're in Chicago, which is a Democrat stronghold.
Yeah, it's where Obama was made his political career. So
yeah, indeed. Despite the fact that he's from Kenya, it's terrible.
He's had an incredible journey.
But it seemed to me, at least the first like half hour, I was quite concerned because going to this, Trump, all he needed to do was not be crazy. All he needed to do was seem vaguely presidential. In the first half hour, he seemed to manage to do that. They initiated the conversation by talking about jobs and job creation, job policy, and he gave us some policies. He wanted to lower the corporation tax to 15%, which would take the US from the third highest corporation tax in the world to one of the lowest, on a par with places
Ireland?
Like Ireland. Yeah, well, Ireland has a corporate tax rate of 12.5. So bringing it down to that level would thoroughly transform the job space and the business creation space in the US. Did you get that kind of impression? Was the bar... I'm actually quite interested about this. Was the bar... visibly nervous in the first like half hour when Trump managed to not just scream China into a microphone?
I wouldn't say so. I mean, I mean, I sort of like I watched the second half of the debate like back at the hotel room because I'd like work to kind of semi deal with in the background. But I did watch the bit you're referring to in the pub, and it seemed like it was kind of hard to tell what was being effective because it was just so obviously groupthinky in the bar, if that can be used as an adjective.
I think that there's also a huge amount of that in the media at large afterwards as well. So much of the analysis afterwards was like, oh, Clinton like wiped the floor with it. And I think that everybody around Clinton is also going to be feeling very calm about it. And that is what actually worries me about the whole Clinton campaign, about everybody who is voting Clinton. I'm super, super worried that this complacency and that little shimmy that Hillary Clinton did, that frankly came across as really smug, kind of represents the little bubble that they're in that shows. I don't think anybody who is from like who's doing reasonably well in liberal circles, don't think anybody thinks that Hillary would be it's not qualified to be president and would be a bad president. But they are not the people that are deciding this election. The people that are deciding this election are like poor white people in Pennsylvania.
That was the thing that kind of struck me, is that if you're watching the debate and you're like just mocking Trump, or you just have total contempt for what he's saying, which isn't necessarily an unfair position on its own, but I do kind of wonder how, if you'll say, so the bar was filled with like young Democrats. I think actually the Young Democrats of Illinois, which is a youth wing of the party,
sounds like Momentum.
It's probably not that extreme, but they'd obviously like set up there, and you kind of think like how's like a metropolitan young person supposed to empathize with, as you say, some white people in rural
Pennsylvania. People who have genuinely seen their jobs shipped overseas by companies that they used to work for, seen communities that they grew up in, many times the only communities that they've ever known, be decimated by the amount of job losses in the areas. So we have this problem in like northern and working class towns in the UK. And the US has that problem in the Rust Belt, where an awful lot of their traditional manufacturing happened. Shifted a lot more as a nation to service-based economies, whereas the US still is like their memory of being a manufacturing nation is still a lot fresher in their minds, I think, than it is for the UK. Although Brexit happened,
I'm not sure that comparison is necessarily true, but certainly in terms of how we discuss politics, I think manufacturing is far more in America's minds, let's say, than in Britain's minds.
I genuinely do think that the only difference there is the passage of time, where our manufacturing peak was decades ago. But for the US, I think that they were still like a strong manufacturing nation into the 21st century, whereas I think that we had already kind of dropped off. Those arguments and those sentiments are still the same. I think they're a lot fresher in the US than they are in the UK.
Well, it did strike me that if I'm going back to our rural voter in Pennsylvania, if I'm listening to Trump talk about jobs being moved abroad, and then I've got this quite smug figure of the establishment in Hillary Clinton, trying to attack him, I can see the draw.
Shimmying her shoulders and going, okay. And saying, you know what, I did prepare for this, and I prepared to be president. Those are like brilliant lines. Some lines were shit. Trumped up, trickle down should never really have been floated to the American public as a whole. I think that is a terrible little catchphrase that you have there.
I don't know, man. I think Americans maybe respond to those sort of corny catchphrases a little bit more than we do.
I don't know. If you are American, dear Nisola, please set Jimmy straight, because Trumped Up, Trickle Down was terrible.
I'm not saying it isn't terrible, but you have to, like, there's certain things that you can get away with in the States that you wouldn't be able to get away with in Britain, and vice versa in terms of political campaigning. So I'm wondering if there's maybe just a cultural jar between us and them on this.
Well, as long as they know that their taste is a lot lower than ours. We talked about like the first half hour being actually showing Trump in a reasonably good light. Mm. Do you like it very quickly descended into chaos? He spoke at length about his tax returns, the fact that he's the only presidential candidate of the two major parties in, oh God, decades that hasn't released his tax returns. He says that it's because of auditing, which is a load of bullshit. Mm. Being audited does not affect your ability to release your tax returns, by the way. And then also the stuff about birtherism with Obama. He was one of the spokespeople of that conspiracy theory movement.
I mean, he was one of the chief ones, yeah, for sure. And he, his whole defense on that point, that he it was because of him that Obama released his birth certificate. Apparently, you know, reading up on that afterwards doesn't appear to be true.
He somehow is trying to spin it so that it. Oh yeah, it's actually Hillary Clinton who started that rumor. What? So he did descend into like craziness. He interrupted Hillary Clinton about over 50 times in 90 minutes, which, when you think about it, isn't brilliant. That's a skill there that you've got. Exploit that, because that's nearly once every couple of minutes, isn't it?
Yeah. Well, that's just kind of his personality, though, isn't it? It's he's got a very, very large gob on him.
Yeah. Well, it's a sociopath. Actually from MSNBC, I can't remember who the anchor was, described the whole event as the class clown versus the class president.
I think that
was a fantastic analogy and way of explaining what was happening up there. The thing is, though, if you're going to use that analogy, you end up with nobody liked the class president, because they were always up their own asses. They were always better than you. You kind of resented them for that fact, and you kind of wanted the class clown to do well because he was like you. He was the underdog. He was funny. He was entertaining. And we have kind of seen that from Fox News to a certain extent, in that they have basically made a string of apologies for Donald Trump and saying that, nobody won this debate. Where, if you do it from a debating standpoint, Hillary Clinton clearly was the winner. It was incredibly clear that she was the winner. She was the most composed. She was the most persuasive. But the problem is it's not really
about the debate, though, is it?
No, it's not. I don't think it is about the debate. Although we are seeing a bump in Clinton's percentage points. This is 5 or 6 days later. We've seen Clinton with a 4 to 8 point lead in key states that tend to be more blue leaning, tend to be more Democrat leaning, in Pennsylvania, New Hampshire, Colorado, Virginia, Wisconsin, and Michigan, which is like. Some of them are part of the Rust Belt, where she really does need to win. Mm. And then she has a tighter lead in places like Florida and North Carolina, which are states that she basically needs to that she should be aiming to carry, essentially.
If you look at 538's broader forecast, the gap between the odds of Clinton winning and the odds of Trump winning has massively opened up since the debate. So I get in that sense, she obviously won the debate. Or at least it certainly appears that way at the moment. She's currently on 67% chance of winning, and Donald Trump's on 32-33.
Do you think that's still you flip a coin three times?
Yeah, right, there's still a chance of Trump winning, for sure.
Yeah, one of those times. Do you think that he could still win?
Yeah, he obviously can.
Even after that atrocious debate.
Yeah, but one of the running narratives of this entire presidential campaign is that Trump can win on using strategies that people previously thought would never be able to secure somebody the presidency. You know, a lot's been said about this kind of post-fact world, but it's a lot of it is to.
I hate the use of like, oh, this is the post-fact world. This is the post-meme world. Fuck
post-meme.
Off.
Well, I don't know that politics is that much more dishonest than it's ever been, but I think people notice the dishonesty a lot because of live fact-checking and that sort of thing. But
They're actually fact-checking now, which is very exciting.
Yeah, yeah. But the point I was going to make is that ultimately, for a lot of voters, they're not going to follow up on any of the claims either of the presidential candidates make. They're just going to take it on trust. And if it comes down to who do you trust, the class clown or the class president... If you've gone for a period of potentially several decades where the political class is perceived to have let you down, you're going to be willing to trust the class clown far more than you otherwise would be.
Yeah.
So.
It's basically if you are voting for the class president versus the class clown, and the class president has basically been bullying you for the past 20 years.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, not Clinton personally, but the sort of people she hangs around with.
Yeah, I think that a lot of people are unable to make a distinction between those two things, apparently. So let's, from one leadership race to another. Did you like that segue?
That's pretty good. You should probably stop pointing out the segues when you make them.
Oh, no, but they're very rarely good for me. the Labour Party of the United Kingdom of Great Britain and Northern Ireland, we'll see how long that union stays together, had a party conference where Jeremy Corbyn was declared leader, winner of the leadership competition. As if he dialed in and he's won a trip to Ibiza in a car.
That would probably be a better way of doing it in many ways, you know, rather than this whole campaigning thing.
They were in Liverpool, and there actually ended up being two parallel conferences that were taking place that the media seemed to be focusing on. One was the traditional Labour Party conference, and which was dominated by the Parliamentary Labour Party. Those who are MPs and representing their constituencies in Westminster. And then there was Momentum, who are the campaigning organisation that were created after Jeremy's initial election last year in order to maintain momentum. You see where they got their name. Jeremy won again. We all knew, why the hell did they bother doing this leadership election? It costs a lot of money.
I think they felt they didn't sufficiently embarrass themselves over the first part of the year, and they really needed to entrench that kind of shame and public humiliation.
What has been like? Have you been following the the conference very much? And what do you think are the main takeaways of it that you've kind of noticed?
I think the moderate section of the Labour Party has finally accepted that Jeremy Corbyn is going to be leader, and there's a fair chance that Momentum and their affiliates are going to entrench their advantages further within the party, by which I mean take over more of the party machinery. So there's been that element of it. It's been it marks a defeat for the Labour moderates, at least for the foreseeable future.
The MPs just seem really sad, don't they? It's very. I just feel very sorry for them. I was listening to a podcast that had Jess Phillips on it, and I bloody love Jess Phillips. She's brilliant. I want her to be my friend.
She's not brilliant. She's a bit embarrassing. But go on.
I think she's brilliant. I want her to be my friend. And we might be able to get her on the podcast, Jimmy. Don't be a dick.
Well, she won't be doing very much in the Labour Party for the future. So she's got some time opened up in her schedule.
I'm also trying to do a thing with Nick Clegg, and I'm like, you don't have very much to do now.
That's not how you get people on the side, Jazza. Not that I'm Mr. Diplomacy myself, but yeah, I've noticed a few things.
Fair. But I think that it's very interesting that you're saying about the left wing of the Labour Party really entrenching itself in the mechanics of Labour, because that seems to have been a lot of the criticising. Or the criticism that has been happening over the past week or so in a lot of media and a lot of pundits as well, that it is still very much the Labour Party having conversations with itself.
That is what a conference is supposed to be about, though.
No, but I mean in terms of what the party is doing at the moment, and especially at conference, which is kind, as well as being a conversation with itself and about how the party works, it's also meant to be a place where they can strike up ideas, strike up conversations, and come to term and decide like policy ideas. And something that was widely reported by a lot of media was the lack of any discussions over Brexit.
Yeah,
which I think is absolutely like it's the biggest thing happening to the UK right now.
It is the biggest thing, but Labour as a political force have almost no say in how it's going to be completed, right?
But there are like select committees that they can be part of. There is lending a voice to those who perhaps feel disenfranchised by the way that we are leaving the European Union. Like, there's still a role for an opposition as we decide to leave the EU. And the Conservatives certainly need to have their feet held to the fire for the way that they choose to do it, because it's going to define our country for the next generation, isn't it?
Yeah, I think there's internal opposition within the Tory party, particularly the division between the Brexiteers and the Remainers.
Hard Brexit, soft Brexit,
exactly. And I think that's going to...
I prefer mine soft, soaked in almond milk for a few minutes before I dive into my Brexit. The cereal gag is never going to get old.
Yeah, I've totally lost where my point was going now.
But the problem was with, so I think that the lack of Brexit kind of talks and events at the Labour Party conference this year is kind of like a symptom of the fact that it is the left trying to take control of the party. So a lot of the discussions and a lot of the focus seems to be of how can we get certain people onto the National Executive Committee? How can we perhaps think about deselecting current what they would call right-wing MPs? And I think it's a great shame, because now more so than a year ago, we need an effective opposition in order to make this big jump off of a cliff that we've decided to do as a country, and make sure that that people's viewpoints and people's livelihoods, people's jobs, people's prospects are protected to a certain extent. And all that Labour wants to talk about is how we're going to be able to get some really left-wing people into this seat in Chiswick. Give me a break, man.
It's an exciting time if you're of that left-wing strand within the Labour Party, or even not within the Labour Party, because it is the first chance they've had to seriously seize control of what was a major party of government since Michael Foot stepped down, or, you know, since Neil Kinnock battled with the militant tendency during the 1980s. So I can understand that. It is surprising to me that there isn't, more focus on Brexit, though.
Of course it's huge, well, because I don't think a lot of the left really care. They just care about having control over this party. What was also something that really kind of shocked me, resonated with me, made me sit up in my seat, was how they don't expect to be in power, like in any way, shape or form, and being in power seems to be the last thing on their mind.
Explicitly stated, or was that just an inference you drew?
It was an inference that I drew. So there was I think it was during the Tom Watson speech, he said we need to be a party that gets power, and people booed.
That's a fair inference to draw then, if happened.
And I'm not just plucking it out of my ass, like this shit happened. But I think that is shocking, and it kind of reinforces the stereotype of Labour being a party of opposition, and then kind of and not built for power, whereas the Tories will take power over principle every time, right? Which is why we had a Scottish referendum, which is why we had an EU referendum, and how they ended up becoming the largest party after the last election.
I think you could say that an opposition party that is being effective can still affect politics, because one thing that Labour have consistently managed to do in one form or another since the end of the Second World War is to push Britain, socially speaking, to the left, But if you look at like the concessions that the Tories have had to make over the generations on most recently things like gay marriage, even though the Tories have ended up enacting some of those reforms, it has been Labour's pressure from Labour, I think, predominantly, that has actually moved the, you know, moved Britain socially to a more liberal kind of mindset, if you see what I mean. So you can still be effective as a political party in opposition.
But do you really think that Labour in its current state, where they're worrying about how to get infrastructure in their party to entrench power for the left, which is kind of ironic because they don't seem to want to have power in the wider country, don't you think that there's a bit of... don't you think that the chances of them being an effective opposition, even with them kind of like having a stronger mandate with Jeremy's election, do you think that that's ever going to happen? Because I don't see it happening.
I think what they'd have to do is significantly shift the terms of the debate and British people's general political prejudices and views. So Labour has, you know, consistently been seen as fiscally weaker than the Conservatives throughout its entire history. Perhaps with the exception of when Tony Blair was in power. And a lot of people don't understand anything about economics. I mean, me and you are vaguely interested in politics, and we don't understand that much about economics.
Well, so speak for yourself, I budget.
Okay, but you see the point I'm making, that by and large, people don't understand economics. So it's kind of taken on trust that the Tories are economically superior to Labour. Nobody actually can really demonstrate this in very solid terms. And it is the thing that some Corbynite apologists in the media are saying, that in a way it is all about the debate and the way that the media has framed things. There's a certain amount of truth to that. I mean, I don't think Jeremy Corbyn is a very strong leader just personality-wise, but it is true that the way most people understand politics is obviously focused to a degree through the veil of the media and what they choose to portray and not portray. So I think they've got a huge... The left, for them to ever take power, it would be a huge public relations battle. And I think that would just take years and years and years to affect that sort of mindset shift in Britain.
I want to talk about briefly the kind of a lot of media noise that's been around Labour and anti-Semitism.
Mm-hmm.
There was a lack of Brexit talks at Labour Party conference.
Yep.
But looking at the schedules for both Momentum and for the Labour Party, they seem to have replaced all of the time slots that should have been devoted to talking about Brexit and immigration is there a Semitism problem, anti-Semitism problem on the left, and blah 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 blah. And there seem to have been, I don't know how much of this is the mainstream media trying to bring them down and taint them by kind of lifting up particularly anti-Israel sentiment within the Labour Party, of which there is a huge amount. An awful lot of people who go into the Labour Party, I think, come from very hard left-wing kind of like student circles, and a lot of their time is taken defending Palestine and chastising Israel.
Hmm.
And occasionally those lines between being anti-Israel and being anti-Jewish, that they unfortunately tend to blur. And there have been quotations about some of the events that have been happening throughout Labour, where people have asked questions at these kinds of debates about the Jewish question, which whenever that phrase is used in media coverage, it just makes the pit of my stomach like sick.
It's not great, is it?
Yeah.
It's you haven't mentioned Jackie Walker, who I assume you're about to come into.
I have a Google page brought up in front of me right now. She was the vice chair of Momentum of the left wing kind of my campaign group, and she's
been suspended from Labour, but not seemingly from Momentum. For what she's...
Not yet. There's talk about the possibility that she will be suspended from Momentum. Do you understand what she's said/done?
I've heard it reported, but do you have like an exact quote of what it is she said to hand, just so that we have this somewhat right?
I only have second hand sources. I'm not sure if they're. I haven't seen like her actually saying it.
But the gist of what she said was that the Holocaust Memorial Day wasn't inclusive enough, or something to that effect.
Yeah. So Holocaust. It's a shame that Holocaust Memorial Day doesn't. It is only about Jewish people and isn't about other kind of like mass killings of people. International Holocaust Day or Holocaust International Holocaust Day is definitely not what it's called. It's not a celebration of Holocaust. Holocaust Memorial Day. Jesus Christ, Jazza.
Are you trying to get yourself suspended for the Right to Sort of All podcast?
Yeah, pretty much. Holocaust Memorial Day actually does include it's meant to include all genocides,
right?
As well, with clearly the Holocaust being the main one that it thinks about, and also for people of color, people of Romani descent, LGBT people who were all chastised under the Hitler regime, they are all memorized in some way, shape, or form as part of Holocaust Memorial Day. The majority of people who suffered under the Holocaust were the Jewish people in Central and Eastern Europe, and so that's where a lot of the coverage gets focused. Understandably, because a huge proportion of a population of a certain type of people were wiped out. I don't have a problem, as an LGBT person, I don't have a problem with Jewish people getting quite a lot of the spotlight for Holocaust Memorial Day. Mm. Just saying. But based on those comments, where she was like, I wish that was more, Holocaust Memorial Day were more inclusive, she has been suspended from the Labour Party. She and her partner are Jewish.
Yes,
as well.
And one of her partners is a close affiliate of Jeremy Corbyn as well, isn't he?
Oh, does she have multiple partners?
Sorry, one of her partners, her partner, I should say.
Wonderful. Polyamory is coming into the mainstream. Brilliant.
I'm reading a Guardian article on this in the background, and what she's quoted as saying is, in terms of Holocaust Day, wouldn't it be wonderful if Holocaust Day was open to all people who experience the Holocaust? It seems to me this might be a little bit of a storm in a teacup, really. And I'm not generally in favour of people, you know, having a shit fit over something that somebody said.
So Ken Livingston said that, like, he's quoted in this Guardian article, I think we're reading the same one, there's a difference between ignorance and anti-Semitism. She basically said that thing and didn't really know that Holocaust Memorial Day is actually very inclusive, and there are events and awareness things for all people that suffered under the Nazi regime. I think that this is the problem with, like, as they say, the Jewish question, because it's very difficult to hear somebody say, oh, I wish that Holocaust Memorial Day weren't just about Jewish people, and not hear, oh, it wasn't that bad. Do you know what I mean? And that's the reason that somebody gets suspended.
It's a little bit ridiculous. I mean, it is kind of it's an instance of political correctness in a sense. Like, there's certain issues that you'd be wise not really to discuss, because even if you say something quite reasonable, there's a very, very good chance that one of your opponents will twist it out of.
Yeah, you know, I'm almost like, so somebody like Jackie Walker probably isn't actually the problem. The problem is that they're in the same way that Brexit has emboldened a lot of racism and like xenophobia in the UK. We saw xenophobic attacks go up by a huge amount.
Well, reported xenophobic attacks went up.
I mean, that's the only way that is the only way that you can measure them.
Sure,
you can't,
but
guess.
It's not actually, I mean, it doesn't necessarily follow that the number of attacks increased as much as the reports of them increased, if you see what I mean.
Cool. We'll talk about that later. Off air. but I think that what we've seen is with somebody like Jeremy Corbyn being the top guy in the Labour Party has emboldened people on the left who are anti-Semitic. To say and suggest anti-Semitic things, rather than there being like an entrenched racism within the Labour Party. Do you think that might be correct?
I think it might just be a breakdown in discipline. And as you say, like, it, Jeremy Corbyn's rise has somewhat unleashed sections of the party that would have been, you know, covered up or like hidden away under a more Blairite type of leader. It's partly an issue of party discipline, I think, and it's also, I think, people with more, I don't want to use the word extreme, but say more fringe political opinions are more likely to have views that would be considered outrageous to, you know, the centre ground, if you like. So it does kind of follow that this sort of thing would happen.
So from a party with a lot of discipline problems to one that seems to be having few discipline problems at all. JK, there's loads of discipline problems. Theresa May, just this morning, has announced that she would like to trigger Brexit at the end of March 2017.
By the end of March 2017.
By the end of March. What did I say?
At the end of March, but it's by the end.
I mean, split hairs, mate. Come on.
I just want the people to be well informed, you know. That's why we put together this factually robust podcast.
Brilliant. So the Conservative Party conference is starting very, very soon. Theresa May seems to have jumped on the fact that Labour didn't talk very much about Brexit at all and is setting the agenda as these are the terms. Do you think that this is an arbitrary date that she's kind of plucked out of thin air just to keep people quiet for a while? What do you think are the actual chances of us triggering Article 50 by the end of March 2017? Or do you think this is a placeholder?
It's certainly possible that it could be pushed back. You know, in, you know, if circumstances change, she might be able to find some excuse. But I think, generally speaking, she appears to be quite keen to move forward on this and get it sorted. Because of the, like, the 2 year gap, the 2 year gap between triggering Article 50 and Britain actually exiting the EU, which is the period during which the exit negotiations take place, she needs to do it within the next 2 years, probably, in order to have it have the process completed in time for her to fight a general election in 2020. So yeah, I mean, that all kind of makes sense to me. I think the discussions in the media about the business uncertainty and just general uncertainty politically about what's going to happen will start causing her some problems if she doesn't take concrete action soon. But actually, like, it is her stance, I think, is relatively reasonable, that she's taken a couple of months to figure out what course of action she wants to take, and alongside the decision to set a date for triggering Article 50 by, she's also outlined the repealing legislation for the European Communities Act, I think it's called, which is the act that sort of effectively made British law subservient to European law. And I think that's from 1974. So she does appear to have worked out what she wants, and she's outlined a fair amount of detail in terms of the timetables as to what she's going to do. So I think she's kind of on top of the situation, and I don't, you know, not necessarily Mrs. May's biggest fan. But
so she seems to be, but very few other people do. Like, there was Priti Patel was on Question Time last week.
She's a bit of an idiot, let's just point out.
She's managed to get far on that, though. she clearly doesn't really understand what Brexit is going to be. And I think part of that is because Theresa May has really cracked the whip to make sure that people, that her ministers stop trying to define Brexit without her.
Basically all the Brexit ministers, so David Davis, Liam Fox and Boris
they're
Johnson...
They're all pro-hard Brexit, aren't they, really?
They're all harder than softer, but they've all made statements as to what Brexit's going to mean, and then Theresa May has released a statement saying, no, these guys don't know what they're talking about, which has been thoroughly entertaining for the rest of us, but hasn't made her government look particularly unified nor competent.
You know what? It's made her look competent, though. It's made... So I think that actually she's coming across as like the tough headmistress, and I think that kind of like caricature of her that she's building is actually working really, really well. I think people are going to end up fearing her, but actually quite liking her.
I think the British public do appear to have responded quite well to her since she was elected, would be the wrong word. You know,
appointed.
Appointed, yeah.
But there's also like the reports of her wanting to, as kind of like a stopgap in the process of Brexit, maintaining all of the European Union laws that are part of the UK law now.
Yeah.
Which I think that is it's going to piss some people off, because some people literally just want to. Want there to be anarchy and chaos, quite frankly.
A lot of the posher Eurosceptics, like the Dan Hannans of this world, campaigned on Brexit with kind of like a program of mass repealing of regulation, which they believe is tying British business down, a kind of like Reaganite, Thatcherite approach to business regulation. Which I don't think actually the British public really gave a shit about. I think there was a huge disjoint between that kind of tendency and the more
That wing of the Conservative Party will continue to rabbit on about how that's what people voted for and not immigration reform.
I don't think they deny that immigration was a reason. I just think that they also want to repeal a lot of regulation. I mean, there's a Conservative group. I think it's called Leave Means Leave. I was reading about it in the Times today, and one of their spokespeople.
I wonder why they got that phrase from.
Yeah. I wonder where one of their spokesmen said, if we repeal 10% of regulation, we'll get a 0.7% boost in GDP, which is just a meaningless phrase.
Let's make some shit up.
Well, like 10% of which regulation? You know, I mean, how do you even measure a percentage of regulation? Is it by the number of lines that you know in legislation that it takes to describe?
Like, yeah, what does that mean? More of those bullshit figures that don't actually mean anything, but the people that stick in people's minds, because it's like, oh, this correlation definitely exists, and that's the reason that we're in this fucking mess as it is. I think that Theresa May's being incredibly pragmatic about it, because basically what it means is that we can continue. Like, a lot of how the country works doesn't change fundamentally, but it is that whole thing of taking back control. So we end up with all of the with a benchmark of, we have all of the same regulations, but we can change them, repeal them, make new ones based on the fact that we're no longer actually tied to the EU. We've just kind of copied and pasted into our own kind of regulation framework.
So there are some difficulties around that. The main one that springs to mind is that in terms of implementing European rules into Britain, you have European directives and then European regulations. And European regulations take direct effect in Britain without Britain having to write any of its own legislation. But when we leave the EU, it's not actually clear whether those regulations will still be in place. What a lot of people do think is that we'll need to transpose all of those regulations into British law, and it's not as easy as a copy and paste job, because the way
they'd introduce them all as a bill, I would guess.
No, it's way, way, way more complicated.
Is it more complicated?
Yeah, because apart from anything else, Britain has a. This is one of the reasons it was always kind of dumb, Britain joining the EU, but Britain has a common law system and Europe has a civil law system.
Scotland also has a civil law system.
Scotland has kind of a hybrid system, actually.
Is what we ended up having. Shut up. I hate you.
this is just a point of, like, law. Civil law system is way more based on statute, whereas common law is more based on precedent that, you know, is set in court. Mm-hmm. And it's one of the reasons that it's going to be difficult to transpose all those regulations. But the directives we've already transposed anyway, because you have to do them to implement the rules. So that whole process is a total clusterfuck, basically. And it's definitely not going to be a copy and paste job.
Yeah, fun. I'm just, as an update for all of you listeners, I'm still really sad about it. I'll let you know if that changes.
Why are you still sad about it?
Because it was... Because it's just stupid, isn't it?
Is it, though?
Yes.
I think that I still think, like, having had time to digest the ramifications of the decision, that the EU is still quite a contemptible organisation, just that the way it's structured doesn't really work. There seems to be quite a reasonable chance that it will still collapse of its own accord due to various structural flaws. I don't know, man. I don't feel bad about the decision we made collectively.
Yeah, but it was never about that. And I feel as contemptible about the way that Westminster works and the way that our system works. We have a whole chamber of like 800 unelected people. Mm. Like we're the only place that does that, apart from like China and North Korea. Like, it's insane. And that blind spot in, oh, that we created modern democracy and therefore our system is the best, I think is absolutely ridiculous, because I think that actually on paper the European one works better.
It certainly does not work better. I mean, whether or not it works better on paper, I guess you could argue, but that argument you've just said, you said instead of having one bad system, even if you buy the fact that Westminster is equally bad as Europe, having one bad system is worse than having two bad systems overlaid on top of one another. That's just absurd. That doesn't even track as an argument.
What?
Well, you've just said like you don't like the way Westminster is structured. There's definitely quite a few problems with the way Westminster is structured, and you said,
yeah,
I don't like the way Westminster is structured, and therefore I also want to be part of the EU, which is badly structured. I mean,
I think that the EU is better structured than Westminster is structured. And I think that there are positives in being part of the EU that are actually more tangible than just economics and freedom of movement. I think that there's also the communalism that I have always really bought into. And it always comes down to this with me in the EU, the fact that I felt European.
Yeah.
And I am a European citizen, and that's being ripped away from me.
I think the identity argument is fair enough, but it's rather separate from the the constitutional aspects of it.
I think it worked fine. Anyway, what do you think, listeners? Tweet us.
Is that your shout out now?
Calls to action. Leave us 5 stars on the iTunes store, please do. It makes everything so much better for us. It's really nice of you. Also, leave us a review. I might read it out. I forgot to look at
Should we do? We can actually do that right now.
Oh, do you want to pick one this time?
Oh, if they in fact exist, so.
Of course, there's a good like bucket of them. The last person who we read out a quote from basically chastised me for not really understanding
The 24601 reference from Les Mis.
Yeah.
I also didn't pick up on.
Yeah, I'm a really bad gay.
What, for not liking musicals?
Like, I like a musical, I'm just not that into it. Do you know what I mean?
I'm actually quite a fan of musicals. Okay. Some of these are from like years ago, though. It's
That's okay.
I might go to TweetDeck instead.
Don't tell them that. Just like, just read one out. They don't need to know that it's from 2014.
Hang on. We're not doing too well on the fluency of this, are we?
Yeah, we're kind of splattering to a stop like a old car engine. Oh, Jesus, Jimmy, come on.
I mean, someone once described us as a nice addition to the two dudes talking podcast genre, but we actually have 3 dudes on quite often.
Yeah, so, and sometimes a woman.
Sometimes a woman, occasionally.
Yeah.
We've actually got a guest coming up next week in the form of Oscar Pearson, who is the creator of the Chat Politics YouTube channel.
How exciting!
That genuinely is exciting. It's actually a defunct channel now, but he interviewed people like Alistair Campbell, Peter
Yeah,
Hitchens.
Loads of like big wigs.
Yeah, loads of big names, and they're really great interviews. So, you know, before he appears next week, go and watch some of those interviews, and you'll know who he is when he appears. All right.
Well, he's not going to appear. This isn't visual. We might take a photo.
We'll take a photo. Okay.
Right,
should we wrap this up?
No, we just
now?
Leave. No, that was a mess, mate.
I'll do some cutting and editing, and I'll make myself sound smarter than I am.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, sure. Mm-hmm. Okay. I'm not sure that's possible. Mm-hmm. All right. Bye-bye, everybody. Love us, please. Bye.